At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember the housing slump, that thing everybody was worried about before subprimes hit the headlines? Well, it's still around. Lennar, one of this country's biggest home builders, announced this morning it lost almost $350 million in land value alone. That's the ground that its empty houses sit on. And if you can't make money on land, well, how are you going to sell any houses? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, representing America's public transportation industry, delivering 10 billion riders annually, and working for an energy-independent America. PublicTransportation.org. And by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, today, September 25th. Good to have you here. Isn't it nice to get back to the regular old news about a housing slump, to not have to deal with any of that subprime mess? Ordinarily, you'd say yes, I'm sure, but the housing news out today was especially bleak. Sales of existing homes fell for the sixth straight month to the lowest point in 5 years. And if you think that's bad, hear this from Patrick Newport. He's an economist with the forecasting firm Global Insight.
I think we're going to see some really ugly housing numbers over the course of this year. I don't think that prices are going to turn around until sometime in 2009. So we're still a year away from the bottom.
One of those numbers Patrick flagged is the inventory of homes on the market. It's at a record high. There's a 10-month supply of them waiting out there.
Until that inventory number comes down, we're not going to see a lot of new construction, and it's the construction numbers that affect GDP. So we're going to see fewer homes being put up, and we're going to see more layoffs in the construction sector.
Not to mix metaphors on you here, but home builders are starting to post car company-like numbers. Lennar said today it lost almost $700 million in the first 9 months of this year alone. Protests continued in Myanmar today. Thousands of people took to the streets all over the country. Public demonstrations were first set off by rising fuel prices a week ago. Late this afternoon, the government banned public gatherings of more than five people at a time. This morning at the United Nations, President Bush called for more economic sanctions against the Southeast Asian nation. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now on how you sanction a country that has a shaky economy to begin with.
Natural resources, especially natural gas, are the mainstays of Burma's economy. But there's not a lot of economic activity there. The government keeps tight control, the infrastructure's in terrible shape, and the country's still very poor. The U.S. started imposing economic sanctions a decade ago.
There's not a lot left to sanction. Americans already don't do much business there, and they'll probably do even less, so it won't make a big difference.
Bill Reinch heads the business organization, the National Foreign Trade Council. He believes sanctions only work when they're imposed by groups like the United Nations or at least several big countries.
You can't find very many cases, if any, where an action by a single country has made much difference, particularly in a global world market. The things that you are denying the target, whoever it is, can almost always be acquired somewhere else.
For Burma, that somewhere else is the rest of Asia. Ken Rodman teaches political science at Colby College.
The fact that
China, India, other Asian countries are engaging in normal business ties with Burma means that that impact is limited.
He thinks that would be true, even if the U.S. forced American companies to divest from Burma completely, and compares the situation to the Sudan, where Western companies were finally pressured into leaving, only to be replaced by Chinese and other non-Western companies. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates heads up to Capitol Hill tomorrow with a $200 billion wish list in his pocket. Marketplace's Steve Henn has the details of one line item.
Some of the biggest winners in the president's war budget are the makers of so-called MRAPs. These are huge trucks that feature blast-resistant armor and V-shaped hulls. They're better able to withstand roadside bombs than armored Humvees, but they aren't cheap. Winslow Wheeler follows the military at the Center for Defense Information.
They're extraordinarily expensive. Costs are anywhere between $750,000 to $1.2 million per vehicle. That's a lot of money for the functional equivalent of a Jeep.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates will go before Congress tomorrow and is expected to ask for an additional $17 billion for these trucks. John Pike, who follows defense and intelligence issues at globalsecurity.org, says this investment is overdue.
Roughly half the Americans who've been killed in Iraq have been killed by roadside bombs.
The real question, according to Pike, is why it's taken the Pentagon and Congress so long to increase protections for troops facing roadside bombs. Wheeler says until recently, most congressional appropriators were focused on earmarks for heavily armored Humvees and a few other things.
They're also busy adding earmarks for things that have nothing to do with the war, like bicentennial celebrations in the defense budget for the Lewis and Clark expedition, for Memorial Day parades, for fisheries, for brown tree snake eradication programs.
But now, heavily armored trucks are all the rage, and Wheeler says he expects Congress to end up spending billions more on so-called MRAPs than the Bush administration is asking for. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Here's a story that might sound familiar to those on a budget. Your bank account is running low, but still you make a couple of small purchases using your debit card. Next thing you know, bam, you're slapped with an overdraft charge for each one of them. The House Financial Services Committee is set to consider a bill that would force banks to let you opt out of overdraft programs, and it would oblige banks to warn you if you're heading into the red with some of those ATM transactions. Jeremy Hobson reports now from Washington.
The Center for Responsible Lending says consumers are hit with $17.5 billion in fees every year for overdrawing their checking accounts. And the center's research director, Ellen Schlomer, says young adults are hit the hardest.
They've been dubbed Generation Plastic, and they rely a lot on credit and debit cards.
Schlomer says 18 to 24-year-olds pay more than $3 in fees for every dollar they overdraw. And now Congress is considering legislation to change the rules for overdraft fees. House Democrat Carolyn Maloney of New York is the bill's chief sponsor.
And what my bill does is basically provides information to consumers so they can make a choice whether or not they would like this service.
Right now, banks can automatically enroll customers in overdraft protection programs. The banks cover consumers who go into the red on their accounts, but then hit them with a fee. Maloney's legislation would allow customers to opt out of overdraft protection programs, and if they didn't, they'd get a warning before being charged a fee for overdrawing at an ATM.
It's basic information. We have the technology. Let consumers know.
Not everyone agrees. Nessa Fettis with the American Bankers Association says banks don't have the technology to make the proposed changes, and she claims consumers like the convenience of overdraft protection on their debit cards.
I would expect that at the point of sale where you've already bagged the groceries or you've already consumed the meal, the customer wants the bank to pay the transaction.
There's been intense lobbying from both sides today ahead of tomorrow's expected action on the bill. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Investors were of two minds today, buying technology shares, selling housing-related stocks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As the UAW strike against General Motors extends into its second day, the effects are beginning to spread. Two GM plants in Canada have been shut down, and the Teamsters Union has promised to stop carrying cars made in Mexico up north into the U.S. market. There's no indication one way or the other how long the strike's going to last or how much damage it might do to an economy already battered by the housing meltdown and the credit crunch. But commentator Dan Neal says the strike is about something bigger than that anyway.
A lot of Americans probably assume this is just one more sorry chapter in the UAW's insatiable quest for more money, more bennies, more job security, so auto workers can sit on their fat keisters and turn bolts for $70 an hour. Fine, but then lots of us should start clearing out our lockers, too. See, the UAW's fight is our fight. This strike is a piece of the larger narrative of American industrial competitiveness, for which we have no concerted national policy going forward, and for which we have no wisdom to light our way. Take health care. GM's competitors, Honda, Toyota, BMW, aren't burdened by employer-paid health care costs, and it should surprise no one that this unique cost-per-unit advantage of hundreds or even thousands of dollars has translated into superior products and value, and a decades-long rout of the Big Three. Or take what the union calls job security. This is a pretty phrase for the threat of massive offshoring. Make no mistake, in a global market where Chinese, Mexican, Korean, and Indian workers get paid a laughable fraction of U.S. auto workers' salary and benefits, there is no compelling reason to build cars and trucks here. Unless, as a nation, we give companies incentives to keep manufacturing onshore. Innovative new products aren't the problem. GM has a raft of great products in the pipeline. Market share is stabilizing. Healthcare and pension costs aren't. But no one has the big picture. No presidential candidate is talking about an integrated view of economic competitiveness. That new business model has to unify public strategy on healthcare and education and monetary policy to help us manage this accelerating shift to a multipolar global economy. Instead, we're drifting. Whatever else you think about the GM strike and the UAW, you have to give it to organized labor. At least it's organized.
Dan Neal is the car critic at the Los Angeles Times. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. You probably realize this back in your subconscious someplace, but a little reinforcement never hurts. According to the ratings people at Nielsen, last month Google handled 54% of all internet searches in this country. Yahoo was a very distant number two at 20%. But those long odds don't deter those who think they can build a better mousetrap. A company called PowerSet is the latest to get into the search business. Leo Laporte follows technology in his podcast This Week in Tech. Leo, good to have you with us.
Hi, Kai.
When you hear about companies thinking about taking on Google, do you worry a little bit about their sanity? I mean, is it a big David and Goliath thing here?
I don't know if it's even close to David and Goliath. I mean, Google is totally dominates the landscape. Just think about how you use the internet. What do you do when you search? Google's a verb, for crying out loud.
And yet now we have this thing called PowerSet, which we are told is going to sort of revolutionize plain language searching. What does that mean?
Well, if you're going to go up against Google, you've got to find some secret sauce. I mean, Google's been doing this for so long, and there are so many websites that you can't possibly hope to compete by building a better database. You have to have something magic. And what PowerSet's doing is they claim that their search engine understands language and so will give you better search results by using artificial intelligence. I just want to point out that artificial intelligence has been a horrendous failure since the day the term was coined.
Yeah, be strategic for me here. Where is Google weak in the search field?
Google's weak in one particular area. I think Google relies on people trusting them. People are more and more aware of the fact that Google's primary business isn't search, it's advertising. And if people start to feel like Google is aggregating information about what they're doing on the net, if they start to lose trust in Google, that could mean they will start looking for an alternative. And that is an opportunity for another search engine to come along. The problem is Google does what it does so darn well. We're just relying on it.
Two things strike me here, actually. One is exactly that point, that we are just so used to just Googling something and calling it a day. But the other one is, and this goes to the plain language part of it, we have become used to using that weird syntax that you adopt when you slap something in that search box. And so we're not really going to turn around to using plain language.
I think Google has made a point of saying, you know, you can just type anything you want in there. We'll find it. You know, you don't have to worry about thinking about the computer. We'll find it. And they do a pretty good job. Even people who have never used a search engine can figure out. You just type a phrase in there, and Google comes pretty close to getting it. The human, you know, the AI, the artificial intelligence, the natural language really is going to come in with, when it comes to somebody like PowerSet, in understanding more what the intent of a page is. You know, Google and any search engine have a tough problem. They have to look at a web page, which is larded with all sorts of non-information, you know, stuff about formatting and programming languages and stuff, and kind of filter through that and find the gist of what the page is trying to say. That's a hard thing to do, and that's where PowerSet might say, well, we can do that better.
Yeah, pretty big might, though. I bring you back to the days of Ask Jeeves. Remember that little butler guy?
Yeah, Ask is a very good example. They're still around. They've been around as long as Google. They've spent a lot of money on advertising. But they're still a distant second. In fact, really the people who compete well against Google are search engines like MSN and AOL, and that's mostly because they have novice users who haven't yet figured out how to change the search engine their browser uses.
How is PowerSet going to know that it's succeeded?
When people start saying, I'm going to PowerSet your boyfriend. And that ain't going to happen. I got bad news for you. It's a long shot.
Leo Laporte hosts a podcast called This Week in Tech. He also does a bunch of other podcasts and a radio show as well. Leo, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Coming up, it's not easy selling green.
I don't want to be too stiff either, because we want to create cool products in the sense that cool products don't contribute to global warming.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 19 points today, about a tenth of 1%, to close at 13,778. The NASDAQ climbed 15 points, half a percent, to 2683. The S&P 500 basically unchanged at 1517. Shares of Lennar that we started the program with fell nearly 4% after it reported that worst ever quarterly result. The crumbling housing market sent shares of KB Homes and D.R. Horton down as well, more than 2% apiece. Shares of retailers also took a hit after the Conference Board Consumer Confidence Index slipped to its lowest level since November of 2005. Target off 4.5%. Lowe's took a 6.75% drubbing after it announced weaker than expected sales. Merck, the drug company, dodged by more than 27,000 lawsuits over Vioxx, wasn't feeling much pain. Its shares rose more than 1% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity. By Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. These days, it seems that everyone is talking about sustainability. Want to know how you fit in? A new online game from American Public Media can help you find out what the world might look like if everyone lived, or at least consumed, like you. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Consumer Consequences.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for August. The House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health discusses a bill to amend the law regarding the safety of food and drugs imported into the country. And the first televised presidential debate was broadcast on September 26, 1960. John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon went before the camera in a Chicago studio. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. 564 Chinese companies that were in business yesterday aren't today. Beijing has revoked their food production licenses, everything from a rice factory down in the south to an MSG plant up north. Chinese regulators are trying to crack down on the unsafe products that have been making their way to market, both internationally and domestically in China. As it happens, we've got our very own consumer research branch over there. Marketplace's Scott Tong is with us from Shanghai. Hi, Scott.
Kai, how are you?
I'm all right. But you, you on the other hand, have some stories to tell, I gather, about life in the consumer economy over there.
How much time do I have to tell? There's a sense of either things are going to break down or they're not as advertised or they're fake. And we just kind of have to contend with these things when we walk out the door in China. In 9 months, I think we've probably had 9 kind of housing problems, hinges that are breaking down, things that are supposed to be screwed in tight. And we've had probably 3 or 4 milk containers go bad, and they're supposed to have 5 more days left on the expiration date.
Well, give me your on-the-spot analysis then, Scott, and tell me what you think is wrong over there.
Well, when I first got to China, this economist, Will Hess, at Global Insight, one of the first things he told me was China is moving at different speeds. I think about Shanghai, and it's building the tallest building in the world. It's got these fancy French designer stores on the one hand. On the other hand, the figuring out how to transport meat in a truck so it'll stay cold, how to spot check that, how to regulate that. Now, we have seen this before in history. Americans will recall a book about the meat supply where these dead rats got into the sausages, and meat companies would bribe the government inspectors so that they could take sick cows and slaughter them to put the beef into the beef supply. That was America. Upton Sinclair and the Jungle. It was almost exactly 100 years ago when that book came out, led to this public outcry and the FDA being established in America. Well, China's moving along that path. And what is exciting and fascinating about China is in America, it took 100 years to get to where things are today. China's trying to do the same thing in a generation, maybe 20 years or less, to jump from being one of the poorest countries per capita in the world to pretty soon the world's number 3 economy. It's going to pass Germany in the next few months.
When you go out, though, Scott, and do your reporting for stories that you bring back to us, do the old hands who were there tell you things are really getting better? I mean, is it really happening, or is this just something that the Western world kind of wants to see?
We talk to a lot of other expats, other foreigners here, and when we kind of grumble about how our life here doesn't match our cushy life back in America, they say, you should have been here 5 years ago. You should have been here 10 years ago, and think about all the things that we didn't have in China then as far as choice and product quality, because there's now this whole range of low end and high end here in China. So that's kind of one marker, I think, of change that's happening quickly. There is this growing conversation that things are changing slowly, but they're changing for the better, and consumers are becoming more and more aware of these things, and they're going to demand product improvement within China.
And, you know, those consumers have more and more money, and obviously, well, maybe not so obviously, but they, in theory, have more and more of a say in how things are going. Where do they go? Who do they buy from?
Well, they buy things with logos on them. There is a big sense of brand name awareness here in China. And there's kind of this flight to quality going on where they will pay sometimes top dollar for something that they think not only has the brand name cachet that they can impress their friends, and that's a big thing here in China, as you know, but also because they know the quality is going to be good. For instance, mostly when people buy a laptop computer, they're going to buy a Western brand. They're going to buy HP. They're going to buy IBM. There's a sense that the Chinese brands are inferior.
Interesting that IBM's owned by Lenovo, though, don't you think?
Well, and the other interesting thing about that is, you know, my cousin is this big computer fanatic, and he kind of shakes his head when he talks about the IBM used to have this kind of American cachet, and now it got bought by Lenovo. And there's a sense that, well, it's part of a Chinese company now, and by definition, in his words, the quality is going to go down.
Scott Tong, Marketplace's man in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
Okay. Thanks, Kai.
Once an entrepreneur decides on a product, and maybe right after she's gotten her startup money, she's going to have to make what might be the most important decision of all, what to call it. Because when it comes to getting attention, a good catchy name is everything. As environmental businesses begin to flood the market, they're turning to corporate branders to set their wares apart from the pack. Claire Schoen listened in on some brainstorming sessions between some San Francisco entrepreneurs and the branding company Lexicon.
Well, there's going to be a huge scramble in this marketplace for ecological something, anything, really, okay?
That's Lexicon's president, David Plasek. His latest client, San Francisco entrepreneur Chris Erickson, is looking for a name for a hot new product. It's a credit card that allows customers to offset their carbon emissions. At a recent brainstorming meeting with Erickson, Plastic scribbles furiously on his notepad.
If we created a brand here called True, you're being true to the planet, true to yourself, give me your pluses and minuses of that.
Little things go off in my head about religion. I don't know where that came from. And I don't want to be too stiff either, because we want to create cool products in the sense that cool products don't contribute to global warming.
Mm-hmm. Now Plastic needs to go back and work his magic to come up with just that perfect name.
It's glue. They have an idea, okay, that they want to bring to the marketplace. You have to make that idea stick, right? You have to get people's attention. And the brand name is the first element of that stickiness.
Finding just the right name is key to unlocking the green market. But there's more to it, as Joel McCower knows well. He runs greenbiz.com, which helps companies who want to go green.
There's the naming of things. There's the visual elements. Is it trees or oceans or kids? Who are the spokespeople? A strong male voice or a more maternal kind of voice? So you've got to really think it through.
Whatever the voice, it won't get through unless consumers trust the source. McCower says Erickson and his partners are solving that problem by teaming up with three major environmental organizations.
The connection to the environmental groups gives them a front door, direct connection with hundreds of thousands of potential customers. The fact that they're playing with Big Green, the major environmental groups, brings to this offering a market that I think most others would kill for.
Regulatory, political, and economic landscape. And we want to be steady through that.
But first, you need a name to die for. So Erickson and his partners sit down and hash out the 43 options that Lexicon has dreamed up.
Green 2.0, Greenside, Triple Green, Green Silk, ooh, smooth. Then they had sort of zippy names like Zift and Wix and Zeal with an X. We had names like Biome and capital G and Cooler.
For Erickson and his partner, Michael Galopter, one name topped the list. It's Cooler.
Cooler makes you ask a question and dig in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you get to create a narrative with a name like Cooler.
Be cool.
Cooler inside.
Be a climate cooler. I think it all works.
So Cooler it is. But does this name have the stickiness, as David Plasek puts it, to become a household word? We'll find out when the Cooler credit card is released later this year. I'm Claire Schoen for Marketplace and American Radio Works.
For more about entrepreneurs staking a claim in the environment business, there's a link to Green Rush, a new documentary from American Radio Works, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, if it absolutely positively has to be there overnight, it might not be. The FAA shut down all airline traffic within 250 miles of Memphis, Tennessee today. There was a glitch in some communications equipment at an air traffic control center near there. Some flights were being cleared by mid-afternoon, though. Memphis is the world's busiest cargo hub. More than 4 million tons of air freight went through there last year, most of it carried on the airport's biggest tenant, FedEx. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow, 19 points to the upside. That's a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ up 15 points, half a percent. The S&P 500, basically nada going on. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on this program, the name game gets personal.
Certainly, people will begin to argue about who is Latino enough, who is Hispanic enough, who really counts, who doesn't count, because then you're dealing with the allocation of resources.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.